Welcome to Honorverse Today, the Honor Harrington podcast brought to you by TPE Network. Let's be about it.
Hello there, Honorverse fans. Welcome to our next exciting episode of Honorverse Today. This is Raul Wybera, and I am joined by our good friends Jim Arrowood and JP Harvey, as always. How are the two of you this fine day?
Oh, I'm doing really good.
Great here, too.
Well, I am glad I'm done with this week. For me, this has been week from hell. Everything I've touched has broken, just so you know in advance. Hopefully, that means we'll only have to do this recording once, though.
Oh, yeah.
It's been one of those. In fact, I had some technical problems just getting on to be able to do the recording. So hopefully that's all the breakage that we have from this one. Well, that said, today we're going to be talking about A Call to Insurrection, which is the fourth Manticore Ascendant book with sadly only one more, according to the interview we heard last time, only one more coming, I think.
Yeah.
Sadness.
At least there's one more coming.
At least there is one more coming. But
and the sad part of it is we'll probably be all senile by the time we get it.
Speak for yourself. Some of us are already there.
Yeah, I hear you.
We've worked real hard to get there, in fact.
I hear you.
Oh, no, but this was a fun book. I did something weird in my note keeping, though. Hopefully it'll get a good payoff.
Okay.
The way this week has worked, who knows?
Yeah.
But we'll see.
So who wrote this book we're about to record about?
Oh, actually, I was going to let JP answer that after you tell us a little bit about what the book's about.
Oh, okay. All right, got me. Okay.
Thank you. It's not just me. Thank you, Lord. I'm not alone in this.
So here's from the back of the book. Yesterday, the Star Kingdom of Manticore was a small, unimportant interstellar backwater. A quiet little star nation only recently recovered from the devastating blow of the plague years. More affluent than some, perhaps, but with little to attract trade or interstellar commerce. It had little need for a navy, and even less interest in paying for one. But Manticore has now become a target. The Star Kingdom isn't certain who is attacking or why, or what its mysterious foe can possibly want, but Queen Elizabeth I knows she has to find out, and she knows that whatever some of her subjects think, Manticore does need a navy. And it needs allies, friends like the dynamic Republic of Haven and the Andermani Empire. It needs their trade, and to learn from their more experienced and powerful navies. It is the job of officers like Travis Long and his wife, Lisa, to acquire that experience. Of utterly inexperienced diplomats like Travis's brother, Gavin, Earl Winterfall, to build those alliances. They have been sent to the powerful Andermani Empire to do just that. Or the Imperial Navy is one of the most powerful and experienced fleets in the galaxy. But the Andermani have problems of their own. Their Emperor's death is a trigger for insurrection, and now that powerful and experienced Navy is locked in civil war. The Manticoran visitors find themselves squarely in the path of the storm. And before Travis, Lisa, and Gavin can accomplish anything else, they first have to survive. Well, there it is.
There it is.
Yeah. So, and I will kick it over to JP so he can tell us who wrote this.
That sounds good to me.
Somebody needs to tell us who wrote this book.
JP, who wrote this book?
It's a mystery. All right. As with the others in this arc, this was written by David Weber, Timothy Zahn, and also Thomas Pope was involved. as a third writer. It's 480 pages, published in January of 2022. We're getting into some pretty fresh books at this point. If you're listening to this podcast when we're releasing these, you know, these are getting to be pretty recently written books. Story covers the time period of 1542 through 1546 PD. And for the moment, it is the final book in the four-book Manticore Ascendant series, with hints and promises that there may be more. All right, let's jump right into overall impressions. Jim, I'll hand off to you.
Fair enough. Overall, I thought this was a good story, but it was also the weaker one of the set in the Manticore Ascendant series. It wasn't too long or too wordy, and I got through it fairly quickly, so it was easy on the eyes. I'm enjoying the Travis Long saga, and quite a bit, I should say, and look forward to more from this time period. One thing I keep hearing about is the plague years. As mentioned in the blurb, I'm not recalling if we've gotten much more than an occasional reference to this.
I don't think so.
Yeah. And if we'll get more in about it in books later on. So how about you, JP?
Well, until we get more, I think this was a great conclusion to the story arc. Things were wrapped up for me in a way I felt satisfied. But it also seemed like there's room in this part of the Honorverse for future storytelling. And, you know, you mentioned the plague. That might be something I think would be cool for David and crew to explore more. But we'll have to see. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, but don't forget the epilogue.
No, you don't forget the epilogue.
I won't. Yeah, this was actually a very enjoyable story. Two stories, actually. And that was both a strength and a weakness in my humble opinion, because one of the, and this is really the only problem I did have with it. As soon as I were reinvested in one side of the story, you were shifted to the other. And it wouldn't have been so bad if one was an obvious A plot and an obvious B plot. But both story arcs were equally engaging for me. I mean, when we would shift back to Travis and, Gavin dealing with the Andromani, I was sitting there like, wait, no, I want to know more about what's going on with Chomps now. And then we switched to Chomps. And it's like, no, wait, get me back to the Andromani Empire here. Come on. So I will have more to say about this in my wrap up, though.
Okay.
And this is sort of why I took a weird. A different sort of tongue-in-cheek approach with some of my notes. The story as a whole felt more like development, a lot of development for the fifth book that David has talked about in our last two interviews. Usually development, I mean, this really did feel like development for a climax. And I've found over the years that a lot of those kinds of stories are a little less captivating. But I was really pleasantly surprised at the way this novel avoided that. It did keep you hooked. I do have to say, and this may probably belong in my last impression or my final thoughts and impressions, I really like the development of the early Andromani Empire. Keep in mind, I mean, this is the second emperor now with Andrew. So we are early in its development, the same as we are with Manticore. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of fun to see the way Manticore actually had a role in that, even though nobody's ever going to know about it. But this is important, though. It explains a bit why the Andromani Emperor has such a fondness towards Manticore in the later books.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that little aspect of it.
Okay.
So
neat.
Jim, well, I'm going to turn it over to you for the story.
Sounds good. You're going to be happy because I think in my notes here, I separated the two stories.
Okay.
And I don't call them plot and subplot or A plot and B.
No.
I think they're co-plots.
They really are. That's what I said. It's not a plot, B plot. It really is two separate stories interwoven into the fabric of the novel.
So
co-plot, is that a Klingon term?
No, that's Kapla.
So, okay, gentlemen, I'm going to borrow Jim's line if you don't move on.
I know. I better get moving here. Okay, so as always, I will read and pause every now and then. And otherwise, if you have somewhere you want to jump in, please do. On Tomlinson, a holding of the Andermani Empire, Director Tomlinson of the PFT Transstellar Corporation is looking to reassert their independence. She and the people of the colony believe they are being unjustly held as part of the Empire. Freya Bryce, an agent of the Axelrod Corporation, approaches the director with a proposal to raise a fleet of mercenaries, here we go again with more mercenaries, to help regain Tomlinson's independence. Bryce contacts Quint. I love that. The leader of a defunct mercenary group to offer her the job. Bryce promises to provide ships and weapons sufficient to take on the Andermani Navy. Tomlinson accepts the offer, and so does the Quint's group called the Quintessence. Imagine that.
Comments? I thought that was actually kind of clever. You know, one thing that kind of, I kind of noticed this for the first time in retrospect, and I doubt if anything will happen from it, but McIntyre really didn't have a role in this beyond kind of being a kickoff point, did she?
Not really.
Because the whole thing shifts to Quintessence, and then the rather surprise character that we're going to see, at least the surprise in her background that we're going to see a little later.
Yeah.
With that third character. Yeah. So it's like the three people that had a big interest on Tomlinson, and McIntyre is really kind of in the prologue and not much more.
Pretty much. All right. Following the disaster of Jeremiah Lin's assault on Manticore with the Volsung mercenaries, he gathers material for the fight that will certainly happen at Tomlinson. Lin, who is sent by Axelrod to create a diversion in an effort to keep the Andermani busy and their minds off Manticore, takes over the operation from Bryce, whom he sends elsewhere.
Well, not so much him as their boss, but...
Yeah. So, yeah. So Lin is back. Uh-oh.
You know, they still don't... No one even know... Lin is still just smiley to them. It's like X-Files cigarette smoking man.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Lin is the definition of insane in my mind. What mm-hmm. is the definition of insanity? Trying to do the same thing over and over again, expecting different results every time.
Poor Lin.
Yeah. He's a nut. Okay. No, he's a dangerous nut, though.
He's a very dangerous one, though.
He's a good bad guy. I can get behind not liking this guy.
Yeah.
It's a good character.
And part of what makes him a good bad guy is the good guys have no idea who he is. This is the fourth book, and they still have no idea who the bad guy is.
No idea. I wonder if they'll ever really act. Well, yeah, Chomps knows who he is, but we'll talk about that later.
Sort of.
Yeah.
One thing to mention, it's in your next section. Edit this out.
At Tomlinson, there are increased acts of assassination, unrest, and smuggling, which doesn't go unnoticed by the Andermani. They hope to catch smugglers in the act. In the meantime, Elizabeth is in her final months of pregnancy. She meets with Dr. Tolochko, who has known about the possibilities of wormholes near Manticore for many years, but has been dismissed by other scientists, and Elizabeth orders that other experts be brought together to determine the validity of Tolochko's ideas, and are also aware that the attempted action by Jensones may have been motivated by the possibility of wormholes.
Okay. This part gets me a little mixed. One of the things that David has said is that these stories here probably won't go to the actual discovery of the wormholes or the establishment of the wormholes. And we know that's still another, 40 years or more in the future, I think.
Yeah.
40 years or 40 or 60, something like that.
You'd be way more up on that than me.
But this seems to indicate as like, okay, I'm hoping if there's only one book left of this, David, I'm hoping that in this climax, at least at some point, the Stark Kingdom at least discovers, aha, we know there are going to be wormholes here, probably plural, and they just, you know, have to spend the time to find them. And we know the first one they find, of course, from the rest of the Onniverse history, is this going to be to Beowulf.
Mm-hmm.
So even if we don't get the whole junction, at least established, I really hope we get it established. And this is my hopes for the reading. And, you know, the book's already done. It's in David's hands for the final. So
yeah,
we'll cross our fingers and hope. But that's just my thoughts on that piece.
Moving on. As Travis and Lisa discuss their wedding plans, a condition alpha alert is issued when hyper footprints are detected entering the Manticore system. The system is on a war footing until a communication from Admiral Basaltberg of the Andermani Navy arrives. He tells the Manticorans he desires a meeting with Elizabeth and her government.
Mm-hmm.
Winterfall has been appointed to be the foreign secretary. Oh, boy. Poor guy.
Yeah.
Little out of his element.
Yes. He talks with Travis on his take on the Andermani and their intentions. Travis has no reservations about the Andermani and their honor. Elizabeth awakens in the hospital from the prime minister, who tells her about the Andermani arrival. She orders that she be allowed to be discharged and intends to meet with her officials about the Andermani visit.
Later, keep in mind, she was just in the hospital because she had a baby, though.
Yeah, I know.
That's, yeah.
All right. Later, during a reception, Basaltberg invites everyone aboard his ship, but then learns about Travis and Lisa's wedding, and he manages to finagle an invitation to that event. That was so cool.
That was fun.
Immediately after the wedding, Travis and Lisa are to be deployed, of course. They will spend their honeymoon aboard Basaltberg's ship.
How romantic.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
not.
Always wanted to go on a cruise, but I don't. Oh, geez. All right. Gavin is learning his job as foreign secretary through on-the-job training aboard the Andermani ship.
Also known as being thrown into the deep end.
Yeah. He is a quick study and has plenty of help, including that of Travis. Meanwhile, Lynn and Quint meet. She wants Gustav Andermann dead for personal reasons and secures Lynn's promise that he will finish the job if she fails. An agent left behind by Bryce is under orders to make sure Quint does not kill Gustav and tells the operative that he, Lynn, will do any needed killing. Oh, boy. So,
Mercenary fight.
Yeah, it's already getting complicated, okay?
Yep.
And it's always a balancing act with Lynn. Do you notice that?
Yeah. Makes you wonder about his choice in employees, but the flip side is his employees have the people he hires to have this bad habit of ending up dead.
Yeah.
Which I'm surprised hasn't caught up with him yet, because one of the problems in too many movies and stories is like, okay, the hired mercs always end up, or the hired thieves always end up getting killed by the person that hires them. And it's like, you know, people talk, sooner or later, the word's going to get out. You don't want to work for this dude because you won't live long enough to spend the pay.
Yeah. And the company has enough money. They don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so still nervous, Gavin hopes he doesn't mess up and start a war or other incident to taint relations with the Andermani. There is a flurry of encrypted communications between Andermanni ships, and finally Basaltburg announces the death of Gustav I, leaving his son Andrew to become Emperor of the Empire. The planned mission to the seat of the Empire will not be happening. Instead, there will be a cortege traveling around the Empire to give citizens the chance to pay their last respects to their fallen leader. Gavin offers to accompany Basaltburg on this cortege as a way of Manticore showing their respects. The offer is accepted, and the procession heads for Tomlinson. Okay.
I do have a thought here that occurred to me as you were reading this. Gavin and Travis are definitely brothers. they both have this habit of trouble finding them, and a knack for swimming to the surface.
Yes.
Which is funny because they are very different people.
Very.
But it's like a genetic thing with them or something.
Yeah.
Their ability to get into awkward situations.
Yes. Now the plot thickens. This was what's coming up was very intense. At Tomlinson, the Andermanni ship Preussen experiences plasma breaches and a series of cascade failures. Shuttles from Tomlinson arrive, and it is soon apparent that the ship was a victim of sabotage and is being boarded by forces performing a takeover operation. As time goes on, it is discovered that many of the personnel aboard the Preussen are from Tomlinson, and the takeover is successful. Ships provided by Lynn to the Quintessence finish the job, and the Andermanni contingent at Tomlinson is soundly defeated.
And this threw me for a bit of a loop at first. It took a bit to figure out that is Captain Hansen a prisoner?
Yep.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. First big plot twist of several.
So when Basaltburg's ships enter the Tomlinson system, they are tipped off by the former admiral, who is now a captive of the Quintessence. Quint and Lynn were planning an ambush, but Basaltburg wisely orders his fleet to pull up short. This guy's Basaltburg could teach some lessons to the Salarian League. All right.
It might be best that he never did.
Yeah. Andrew, the new emperor, is on board and insists that they attack immediately. He becomes agitated when his order is refused for numerous reasons, most importantly because he has no heir to rule if he is killed. He will not listen to reason and tells his commanders that they will be executed for disobeying his orders once Tomlinson is sorted out. The fleet leaves with plans to return at a later date. Later, he meets with Gavin, Travis, and Lisa. Andrew tells them that there isn't time to discuss relations between the Empire and the Star Kingdom, but he wants to hear about how they dealt with the Volsungs. Andrew is impressed with Travis's stories and has a further request.
Yes.
The plot.
This part of the book is why, it felt like a fast read. Because this stuff was, events are just unfolding quickly, it seemed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, I started to wonder about Andrew. I didn't know a lot about Gustav, but I know he was not a evil person. But, I'm Andrew. I say we're going to do this. And if you don't do what I tell you to do, I'm going to blow all of you away. And it was like, oh, my gosh.
He's confident. To a flaw.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because he's young, as I recall, right? He is a pretty young guy.
What is it, like in his 20s, I thought?
That was the impression I had. Like,
yeah.
So he could be the best dude ever, but he just lacks experience.
Yeah.
A lot of knowledge, not a lot of wisdom. Maybe that's a way to put it.
Right. He needed more experience, but, yeah. or a regent to help him or something. Anyway.
Or at least an heir.
Yeah.
This was a baffling part of the story to me for a second until they pointed out. It's like, if something happens to you, you have no heir. It's like, oh, that's a legit concern.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, we've run into that one before.
Mm-hmm. Might be why somebody just came out of the hospital.
Yes.
Right. In another part of the universe.
Yes.
Some issue about heirs and marriage and those kinds of things. But
yes. So Lynn learns that one of the captains of an Andermani ship, Florence Hansen, is the illegitimate daughter of Gustav, and she is older than Andrew and may have a claim to the throne as well. Meanwhile, Elizabeth meets with her prime minister and Crystal Pine about the wormhole question and who are all attending their conference. There are Axelrod people included on the list, and everyone knows about some of the underhanded business practices and industrial espionage. They also discuss a conflict between the Office of Naval Security and the Special Intelligence Service. Yeah.
And that is sort of the kid. Go ahead, JP.
Oh, I'd say these are the two kids in the back seat of the car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stop touching me. That's my seat.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And it's sort of the kickoff for the second part of the plot, too.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just that, the captain of one of the captains. I mean, that's kind of how it originally evolves, but she ends up pretty much running the whole damn operation, which seems to cause Lynn a little bit of annoyance.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're talking about Hansen?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and it was never certain to me, as the story unfolds, that her claim had any validity. It's like, maybe she is and maybe she isn't, which really made this a sticky problem. Because if she isn't, she's still a problem. If she is actually an heir, that also had sticky aspects to it as well. Yeah. So things that were already busy and complicated just got busier and complicated.
I like
you know, that. And one thing that deserves mentioning here, when you untangle the two stories, it sounds like this reveal happened fairly early. The reality is we were well involved into the story and this plot when this reveal hit, and it was it was far enough along that it was like, okay, this is another major plot twist.
Yeah. Well, as I recall, we, the readers, learn about this claim last, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Pretty like, yeah.
There were already people around her, and this agenda was running when we're made aware of it.
How she was able to take over mm-hmm. so many of the Andermani ships, in fact.
So the oh, by the way, was for us as the readers, not for, you know, she didn't roll onto the bridge one day and go, hey, guys, guess what? I got news. Everybody that needed to know already knew. And here we are driving through the book and it's like, wait.
Yep.
She could be an heir? Huh.
Yeah. Interesting. And she spent years working her way up through the Andermani ranks to get to this point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But she's ignoring one small thing, which comes up a little later.
And yeah. Since the name came up in this part of the discussion, I'll say that one of the coolest names in any part of the Honorverse is Crystal Pine.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's a cool name, but it is.
Yep. And, you know, it starts to look like we may be getting a love interest for Gavin here.
Yeah.
I want to see one of those nobles named like Baron Breakwind or something like that.
Yeah.
Because we've got Breakwater and Permafrost or whatever. We've got all the other ones. Yeah, that would be great. It's okay. The spinoff fanfic that's going to get written that's got silliness in it like that.
Yep. So anyway.
Sorry, David.
Yeah. With apologies. Okay. Upon return to Potsdam, the Saltberg is given command of the entire Andermani fleet for the assault on Tomlinson. Lisa and Travis are to accompany Basaltberg as observers on the mission. Gavin will remain behind for talks. He and his people are escorted to a section of the palace, and they will be under security scrutiny for the duration of their stay. they will be under the charge of a guard named Strossmeyer. Strossmeyer asks Gavin questions about Elizabeth's ascension to the throne and intimates that he may not be a good fit to continue his duties under Andrew's rule. Lisa and Travis discuss their deployments. Lisa secretly worries that one of them might be killed on the mission to Tomlinson. Later, Gavin and Strossmeyer talk. Strossmeyer asks questions about emigrating to Manticore. Gavin requests a meeting with Maria, an aide to Andrew. He tells her about Strossmeyer's conversations with him. Gavin hopes he didn't make a mistake, and if he did, that Elizabeth doesn't hear about it. Please don't tell. Please don't.
Yeah. He had to say something, though. There were just too many red flags.
Yeah, there certainly was. Okay. Basaltberg arrives at Tomlinson and orders the insurrectionists to stand down. Hansen answers by explaining her claim on the Andermani throne and orders Basaltberg to stand down himself. He tries to reason with her, explaining that under the law, rulership passes to a male heir and that she should have followed correct protocol to assert her claim. She informs Basaltberg she has no intention of standing down, and the coming battle will exact a high price. Lynn observes all of this, and Quint reports her forces are ready, and some of them are hiding until needed. At Potsdam, Strossmeyer is accused of being a traitor by Andrew in the presence of Gavin. He is further... Yeah, it sure was. He is further accused of threatening Andrew's life with a bomb. Strossmeyer confesses he is against Andrew's rule and is arrested. Gavin is heralded as a hero, but Andrew orders that the conspiracy will never become known to the public.
Oh, gosh. Jim, everything you say is so accurate, but there is a lot. You somehow managed to compress a lot of plot into an amazingly short block.
Yeah, that's my job. That's why I get the big bucks. That's why I get the big bucks.
Yeah. Dang, that pesky little thing called the Constitution, huh?
Yeah, it always kind of just, you know. All right. So, Basaltberg, Hansen, and Quint prepare for battle. Drones are launched. Hansen actually wants to cause as little bloodshed as possible. Amos, the Axelrod asset left in place by Bryce, intends to kill Quint, but Lynn kills him first. That was
it seems there might be a little attraction between the two.
Yeah,
meaning Quint and Lynn, not Amos.
That was definitely coming through all the way through.
Yep.
You know. All right. Basaltberg thinks he knows the strength of Hansen's forces, and he also thinks he recognizes her battle tactics, but he doesn't actually know what she is up to. He slows his approach to Tomlinson to assess the situation. Under Lisa's advice, Basaltberg launches missiles. Hansen returns fire, and their missiles pass each other. Hansen's ship is hit, causing damage. Basaltberg orders his wedge pitched to avoid damage. Hansen orders that the hidden missile pods that went undetected by Basaltberg's drones be launched. 750 missiles are inbound at Basaltberg. When comms go down on Basaltberg's flag bridge, Travis goes into action and encounters many casualties. A plasma conduit is further threatening the ship, and Travis makes it vent its plasma into space, saving the ship and many lives. Comms are restored, and Travis is relieved that Lisa and the others on the flag bridge are still alive.
Now, just to clarify, these weren't missile pods in our modern day sense of missile pods. These sounded almost like they were jury-rigged box launchers.
Yes. In the modern day Honorverse, there would have been 750 million missiles launched.
No, 750,000. I mean, keep it reasonable.
750 billion, that's with a B. Okay, no. All right. The Saltburg launches 144 missiles in an attempt to deal with a final blow to Hansen. She launches 80 more missiles that again pass in space. When it is all said and done, the Saltburg is victorious. Quint and Lynn need to escape the scene. She tells him to go and change into a mercenary uniform so he isn't killed, but rather he is captured.
Did you notice she made it a point to tell him the uniform was already in his size?
Yes.
Yes, she had it all ready to go.
So what was going on between those two after dinner that the story never told us about?
I don't think I even want to know.
I think we're left to only imagine.
Yes. Okay, prisoners are taken by the Andermani, including Quint and the disguised Lynn. They are taken to New Berlin. The mercenaries are released. Andrew offers Quint a position. Quint's mother was presumed killed by Gustav, but Andrew tells her the real story and that Gustav was not responsible for the loss of her mother. Further, Andrew gathers his commanders and apologizes for his remarks at Tomlinson and tells them he will not carry out his threats against them. Andrew meets Hansen and sentences her to death, and he knows that Strasbourg was working for her. Okay, that was kind of a surprise to me.
Yeah. Not the biggest surprise to be coming out of this, but no. Very much so. One thing, now that the battle's over, that if you remember, I had made the comment in the previous books that space warfare in this period, 400 years before the present, it had almost more of a feel of submarine warfare, whereas in the modern Honorverse, it felt like surface battles between fleets.
Surface naval warfare, yes.
Yeah. This particular case, it kind of feels like it's matured a bit, you know, and of course we're seeing the more mature, much more powerful Andermani Navy, and it's almost like it's somewhere in between.
Yeah,
there's still some of that sense, but it's, you know, it's like a progression.
Yes. Well, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Travis, Lisa, and Gavin are welcomed to attend Andrew's wedding. He will change his name to Gustav II. He calls the trio before him and gives them gifts and his thanks. And he includes other gifts for Lisa on board the ship returning to Manticore. During the trip home, Gavin and Travis discuss their relationship and decide they need to spend more time together. That was cool.
It was very cool.
I was really happy to see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, another way you know the brothers, they both end up pulling off a whole lot of very clever things that, unfortunately, because of circumstances, no one is ever going to hear about.
Yeah. Yep.
Boy, that sucks.
Yeah, well, we got to hear about it, so that's what counts. In the co-plot, Charles Chomps Townsend is summoned before Countess Clavingdale, his SIS boss, and told about the Andermani visit. She wants all the information he has on Basaltburg, and then he is to go on leave far from landing and stay out of sight, especially from any Andermani who might recognize him. He goes to Travis and Lisa's wedding reception, where he accidentally runs into Basaltburg, who recognizes him.
In Chomps' defense, he did not know Basaltburg was going to be there.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Basaltburg tells him who and what he wants to take back home with him, and Chomps says he will try to make it happen. It results in Chomps being fired from the Delphi group. And since there are no berths for him in the Navy, Calvingdale sends him to work as a laborer at a resort in Sarisburg.
That was actually funny.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Well, it was tense and funny.
Yes. Well, this whole Chomps line is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was obvious that Calvingdale had something up her sleeve.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I wondered what it was. I mean, you just don't send a senior chief off and, you know, go chop wood or something, you know, that doesn't work. But anyway, Chomps arrives for his assignment and meets Terry, the deputy sheriff in Sarrisburg. She seems to be a very good police officer, and they talk about an accident that killed the Duke of Sarrisburg and his family in an air car accident. He convinces her to take him to the scene of the accident. He soon discovers that there was no accident and that it was actually a murder. Terry is having none of that since the case has been thoroughly investigated and closed. He persists that the case has to be reopened and the truth known, to which Terry tells him to mind his own business and let it go, which he, of course, has no intention of doing.
These two should be married.
Hey, there's still the last book.
They bicker like they've known each other forever.
Yeah.
They're so much the same person that the friction is there.
Yep.
They are almost instantly married couple relationship.
Yep.
It certainly seems that way, doesn't it? All right. So Chomps looks at several resources and doesn't discover much beyond what he already knows. About all he is accomplishing is angering Terry and her parents, who run the resort he is supposed to be working at. Finally, he gets a break when he finds a man who took care of the Duke's car in a nearby town called Whistle Stop. He goes there telling everyone that he wants to try their famous ice cream, but goes to the man's shop where he discovers the remains of the Duke's air car. Terry is there to arrest him for his activities when he tells her that he has learned enough to prove the Duke's death was no accident. She finally begins to listen. They look further, and Chomps points out that the car's computer was removed and that the mechanic, Devereaux, has it. They go into the house next to the shop where the car is, and there is an explosion in the shop. They also locate the computer, but will have to hack into it to extract any pertinent information. Chomps finds that the computer had been tampered with and disabled the car's radio. He further finds that the crash happened when the Duke, who was piloting the car, had discovered the reason the radio wasn't working and crashed trying to remove the device that was interfering with the radio's operation. He and Terry know they are now targets of someone for what they have learned. Okay.
Yeah. The sheriff.
Yes. The thumb drive. Yeah, there's a thumb drive plugged into the damn computer, and it stopped the radio from working properly. But they tried to blame the Duke was drunk, flying, driving,
right,
something, whatever.
I like that she shows up to arrest him.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, I learned some things. And it's almost like the tone is, all right, hotshot, go ahead and show me what you got. Because she knew that he had nothing.
Yeah.
Only it turns out he had something.
He did have something.
But it was funny. It was like she was willing to say, all right, just go ahead and tell me all this great info you dug up.
And as we've gotten through the parts where it's like, it's fun watching her realize, okay, there's actually more to this guy than he's letting on.
Yeah.
Especially when he pulls out some of it. Yeah, and I don't know if it's at this point or a little late, but he pulls out some of his gadgets and, you know, she's asking questions like, I don't want to know where you got that, do I?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, and then I'm sitting here going, you got fired, Turkey. What are you doing with all this stuff from the shop? You know?
Well, remember, what's her name? The secretary comes to visit him before he leaves, and she decides she's going to have a discussion with him about politics. She's supposed to have a discussion with him about politics. And it's not about, you kind of figure out it's not about what Chomps did to get himself in trouble. It's about his unofficial mission, first of all. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the funny fact that she brought him a whole bunch of whiskey.
Yeah. All right. Terry calls Chomps to an outdoor cafe where the sheriff herself arrives and tells Chomps to stop investigating the crash. He has no intention of letting it go and goes to get the serial number off the computer, but it is missing. Then someone makes an attempt on his life. Chomps suspects that it was the sheriff, but Terry tries to assure him that isn't the case. Chomps and Terry go to the Duke's residence. They discover that there is milk in the refrigerator that shouldn't be sour and suspect it has been spiked with something. Terry further gets word that Devereaux has been found dead under the car. They deduce that Devereaux has moved the computer back to the car because of a crime scene photo. There was a screwdriver pointing, a chisel pointing, and that tip Chomps off. Okay. In the end, Chomps is visited by the sheriff, who intends to kill him. She confesses that it was she and an accomplice named Matheson who murdered the Duke because he was going to fire her for an alcohol problem.
Okay, I got to say, at this point, I kind of became disappointed with this side story. I really loved the Chomps arc. And it's like, okay, so you're going to kill a family because you're going to get fired? Really?
Too much alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Though this does have a connection to how I'm running my notes.
I understand where you're coming from. In the clearing where the air car went down, the sheriff confronts Masterson about coming clean, and she is shot. Chomps uses a shotgun to immobilize Masterson. The sheriff dies from her wound. Her last words were explained that her job was all she had. Okay, so Raul, and I was thinking about this when you said it, her job was all she had. So she would probably be willing to go to some extreme measures to make sure that she didn't lose her job.
Yeah.
Even irrational measures.
Yes. And yeah. Definitely irrational. And of course,
sadly, it happens in the real world too.
We know that addiction tends to, yeah.
And it made her a perfect patsy for Masterson. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, Chomps returns to Landing, where he reports to Calvingdale about the Sarisburg incident. It is revealed that the Duke was Calvingdale's friend, and she wanted to know what really happened. Chomps is reinstated into Delphi, but will spend some time as a clerk. While Chomps works as a clerk, he reviews some video from Travis and Gavin, and he reports that he recognizes Lynn on the scene among the Quintessence mercenaries.
Cliffhanger.
Yep.
And you skipped the biggest plot twist of all.
Which is that?
Who was Masterson's boss?
Ooh, I did. Enlighten me.
Lady Crystalpine. We find out in the very, very last pages of the book. It's like right at the very end. They leave that all hanging. And even up to this point with Masterson, I was so annoyed with this plot line because of the way, you know, because of what I had mentioned before. And then they drop that bomb on us.
Yeah. I have to confess, okay, I put off doing these notes for weeks. Honest to goodness, I put it off for weeks because I was just like, oh my gosh, how am I going to write this? How am I going to truncate this?
It's okay. I would have been tempted to cut that part just so it wouldn't be in there and we can pop it in the discussion.
Yeah. But okay. Thank you.
That was a brilliant plot twist.
Yes.
Because the superficiality of what was going on there, of the motivations, had annoyed the heck out of me as much as I loved this story arc.
Yeah.
And then boom, it's like, yeah, brilliant.
And what feature did Chomps recognize when he was watching those videos?
Smile.
Lynn's smile. Yes. Okay. So with that is the story. Raul, you want to take us through some characters?
I do have a few. I'm going to follow the format I've seemed to have adopted, and it kind of works well. Your plot covers most of them, but I'm going to give the opportunity for some thoughts. Queen Elizabeth, first of all, and the main thing I can say is she seems to be adapting to both her throne and motherhood quite nicely.
Yes, and her baby's father is not that member of parliament.
Yep.
So I mean, Huge spoiler.
Her baby's father is her dead husband.
Yes. So what was all the flap about?
Well, because he wasn't a commoner. Her husband wasn't a commoner.
Yeah. Because at one point, the folks that were threatening her said, basically, don't think that you can just have a baby, you know,
mm-hmm.
from your former relationship because he's not a commoner, which drove that whole search for. But apparently she's like, gotcha.
Yep.
That's a valid point. And then she went ahead and did what she wanted to anyway.
Yeah. There wasn't enough of the queen in this story. Yeah. I like her.
All of the Elizabeths seem to be awesome.
They just need books with just her in it.
those would be, well, I mean, we've gotten some short stories.
Yeah.
With both of the two, but Travis and Lisa Long finally married. Yes. Yay.
Yeah. We saw that coming,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they counted on winding up getting deployed for their honeymoon.
Hey, think of it this way. They got an all expense paid honeymoon to, New Berlin.
Yeah.
To combat. I like Travis's, the little struggle we watched Travis go through, worried about his wife, totally believable, but,
yep.
I'm not sure. It was neat to see him choose his duty over the newlywed desire to abandon what he should have been doing to try and help his wife.
Yeah.
And it worked out, but.
Well, you're talking about in the battle?
Yeah.
It seemed actually like Lisa was more worried.
Yeah, even going into it, right? Because she was
mm-hmm.
superstitious or whatever. I forget what the. You know, the phone rang three times and every time that, or whatever, there was something that had her worry, or it's just novels that she had read, I think. Like, people in this situation always, one of them always dies or something, and she gets over it, and then poor Trav ends up being the real worry wart between the two of them when things are going down. But, you know, he had to make a pretty hard decision about whether or not he was just gonna. Well, I forget how it was worded. Be Commander Long versus mm-hmm. be husband.
Yeah.
Long.
See, obviously they don't have the Hallmark Channel.
Yeah.
on Manticore, so.
Okay, Countess Calvindale. All I can say is she should know better than to let Chomps off on his own. Of course, as we find out later,
I think
she does better. Know better. Yeah, that's why she let better. Chomps off on her own.
She had a plan that we could only, for a time, hope might be in place. And we didn't know what the plan was, but it turns out it was all on purpose.
Yep. Yes.
And she got the job accomplished without with the whole ability to have plausible deniability and to protect her department against ONI.
Yeah, and she got to use a whole lot of unnecessary cloak and dagger horse manure too.
And but it was in fun. The end, she gets a very seasoned clerk out of the deal. So it's good stuff.
Yeah.
Yep. So Lady Christopine, an up and coming supporter of the queen, huh?
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what it seems up until, well, actually that may have been true all along, but up until the final pages.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do see Captain Marcello again, who sort of is one of those regulars that, you know, hey, we've got another episode coming. You want to come in for a walk-in? We need an extra.
Yeah. kind of like Murder, She Wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the world's been in Murder, She Wrote.
Dr. Talachko.
Yeah.
Proposing wormhole junctions, and apparently she's been proposing them for a while. And has been laughed out of academia, it almost seems.
Yep.
Yeah.
So are we going to see more of her in the finale? This is one of the things that makes me think there might be some more, if not in the final novel, at least in some of the short stories, because you can't just introduce a character like her and walk away from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what she's pointing at is important.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And
Jeremiah Lynn. The missing smile.
Miles and miles of smiles.
And smiles to go before I sleep.
Well, he seemed He seemed mellowed in this, or we had more of a look at who he really is beyond being a ruthless killer.
Mm-hmm. I actually am going to skip Freya Bryce. Basically, she just is a setup, a disposable character.
Yeah, seemed that way, didn't it?
Yep. But Admiral Graf von Basaltberg, or Basaltberg, my German's not good enough to know which is the correct. We see him yet again. Has he been in three of the books now?
I think so.
I got to say, I really, really like him. Mm-hmm. Almost as much as Qin Lu in the modern books.
He is very smart.
Baron von Ravenstrange.
Yeah. And he doesn't rush in where fools fear to tread, or however that saying goes. He's going to find out exactly what he needs to do by analyzing it before he jumps in. And I really like people like that.
Yeah. You know, and another thing, speaking of which, and this goes directly along with with what you're saying. One of the things that I do like about him is it's like he sees that there's something special about the Manticorans, and it's like he's the one who's seen it as this is something that's worth nurturing. Yeah, they're way behind us, but this is a good crowd. We really need to develop the relationship and help develop this nation.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Andromani, the new emperor, Gustav II.
Yeah, at first I thought the guy was a fool. But then there towards the end, you could see that even though he doesn't have a great deal of wisdom yet, it will come.
Yeah. Turns he lacks out experience.
It seems like he's a good guy that's young.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Raul, I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
And I forgot about it. We walked past it. And then it was like, wait a minute, I want to ask you about this. Do you think there are similarities between the Andromani and the Manticorans, like that relationship is like Manticore and Grayson in the future?
I hadn't thought about that, but you know what, JP? I think, yeah, that's very much what it's like.
Anything cosmic, but when I read through this, it was like, oh, this reminds me of the relationship between Manticore and Grayson when it first emerged.
It does. It does. The Andromani are taking Manticore under their wing in almost the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like what was invested into Manticore by someone else, Manticore grows up and then does the same kind of thing with another nation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what keeps things going, right? You pay it forward.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it, like I said, that it wasn't leading to anything spectacular. I was just curious, like, was that my wild imagination, or did
no? It makes perfect sense. I'd be curious to know if that was serendipity or intent, though.
We can ask Mr. Weber.
Basil Strassmeyer. He was sort of the person responsible for the whole mess in some ways, and I'll be honest, it was kind of a sad story in some respects.
Yeah, I agree. He was a good character. He just didn't agree with what was coming, and instead of handling it as he should have, which would have been to resign and move on, he decided he was going to try to change it.
Almost a tragic villain with a lot of conflicts.
Yeah.
Aoshin Minister Yugishu Shan, I think that was the Olga as Shan as what, yeah, well, sort of... what was looking like, oh, gee, Gavin's going to have a love triangle. Well, that got shot down at the end there, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
But I wonder if Gavin's going to end up back in New Berlin at some point.
That's possible, I suppose.
I mean, Long's family certainly seems to be instrumental with the relationship with the Empire.
Well, let's look at it this way. Okay, Elizabeth knows that Manticore needs a navy now. Mm-hmm. The Andromani have an established navy.
Technologically advanced, in fact.
Right. So they are going to... So it may be that Gavin is going to go and try to learn, or at least get the Andromani to teach Manticore. Who knows? There could be more than one more book.
Yeah, and this goes straight to JP's analogy between the Manticore Grayson relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, they're far enough away, I can't see the Andromani seeing Manticore as a threat.
Mm-mm. No, no.
And I don't see them as a... And Manticore is far enough away, I don't see them thinking of the Andromani as a potential conqueror either.
Yeah. Well, they're obviously not looking to conquer anything. They've got all they can handle now because their holdings now are starting to rebel.
Yeah. And frankly, their conquests tended to be focused on... I mean, you kind of had to give Gustav a reason to go in guns blazing.
Yeah.
He wasn't just casually shooting up systems.
Right.
Florence Hansen, did anyone see that coming?
Nope.
No.
Yeah.
Nope.
That was out of left field, as they say.
Yep. And since we're mentioning her, we have to mention Jinsan. It's like we're not done with him yet. Even dead, he's still...
Well, he made
but quite, at least that mystery's more or less.
He made quite an impression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Commodore Quint, who's got a real K-drama twist in the relationship with Lynn, not to mention a real K-drama twist in her general plot line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I like her.
Yeah, you do.
She cares about her people.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
you know, and... Okay, she's a mercenary. She's for hire, and usually those people are. But this is a different kind of mercenary. She's not like Jinsan.
No, she's more like Gustav, in a way, if you think of it that way. And Gustav Andromani had a soft spot for mercenaries because that was his start.
Right, and tried to hire her, Andrew.
Well, so. I get a feeling, you know, once she's make sure her the only reason she said no was because she had to take care of her people first.
Mm-hmm.
She had a commitment. She had a commitment to her people. So I really hope, and I wouldn't be surprised at all, if she's back in this last book.
It'd be nice.
Mm-hmm. On the other side of the plot, Charles Chomps Townsend.
It was so great to see this guy get his own storyline.
Yes.
Finally.
And now, it was funny.
Yes.
Now we just have to have a... I was going to say we need to have our own storyline with... and my brain just blanked. Sorry, 62 years old. Skydy Tremaine and... Skydy Tremaine and...
Yes.
What's his name?
That other guy.
It can't just... No. It's
contagious.
Right.
Okay, let's keep moving.
Let's keep moving.
It'll...
The two characters do remind me of each other, though.
Yeah.
They do remind me of each other in a lot of ways.
Yeah, we're talking about a couple few years ago when we last talked about those two guys together, though.
Terry Lasseline, you think she'll be back?
I don't know.
I kind of doubt
Sphinx,
it.
On Sphinx, it's a shame. I liked her and Chomps together.
Yeah.
Like JP said, there was definitely an attraction. There was a... It was almost a hate-to-love attraction from the moment they met.
Yeah.
It was a roller coaster for me because it's like, these two should become best friends or more. And the next minute, I'm like, they need to hate each other and just get over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, it was a wild ride, and it was kind of comical in a way. They both seemed to respect the other, but both of them also needed to be the boss. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, a little one-upsmanship going on. I liked her character, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, her parents, Elaine and Ralph, I really liked, but Terry's the one I really would love to see come back at some point. And maybe actually find out there's, you know, what Chomps really does. But that's just...
You want her to find that out.
Yeah, that's just fanboying, so, on my part.
She was very patient with him, given that she didn't know what he actually did.
Yeah, but she was smart enough to see... The what had to be more.
Yeah.
Even though she had a gun on him at points, the handcuffs out.
He might have liked that. I don't know.
Devereaux was important, but more or less just a fill-in character.
Yeah.
Sad that he had to die, though.
Yeah, smart guy.
Too smart for his own good, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it was tragic.
Mm-hmm. Sheriff Laura Vespoli, like I said, in my opinion, in some ways it was the weakest part of the story, and maybe weak isn't the right word. The most anticlimactic part might be a better word. Even with the plot twist at the end, it's like her motivation, at least, was a little, yeah. But then again, when you look at the real world,
yeah,
you see people doing crazier things for less reason.
Yeah.
In some ways, she was a prop to get the chomp story out there.
Yeah.
And to help wrap it up.
Yeah, yeah.
And to help wrap it up, which leads us directly to Masterson, who was the real mastermind, pardon the alliteration. Or as we find out, maybe not.
Maybe not.
Wait for the last pages of the book.
Yeah.
Now, as far as places, things, organizations, we get around to from Manticore to, I said Griffin. That's not Griffin. That should be Sphinx. Manticore, Sphinx for the Chomp story, Tomlinson, Potsdam, and mostly in the capital city of New Berlin. But the one that bears talking about at this point is the Axelrod Corp.
Yeah, that and the ice cream parlor. Sorry, couldn't resist.
You're saying we need a short story just about the ice cream parlor.
Yes.
Yep. You know, now that we're
Axelrod is interesting.
Yeah.
I want more.
It's almost like it's the beginning of the OFS Megacore mess that drives so much of the Solarian League.
Yeah.
I don't know if that really was a thing, if that had been something that had been going on all along, or is this near the... I mean, it is 400 years ago, half a millennium.
Mm-hmm.
Is this kind of the beginning of the downfall of the Solarian League with things like Axelrod?
Very possible.
And of course, if it's happening here, you can bet it's happening somewhere else. And, you know, Manticore at this point is a verge... even beyond the verge territory.
Yeah.
Cool. Anyway, that's what I had on characters and the places. Did anyone have anything else they wanted to add to those
that I missed? The ice cream parlor. No, I'm just...
Oh. You and Anthea both. Yes, sir. All right. So, yeah, you and Anthea both with the ice cream lately. Oh, okay. Well... Since we don't have ice cream here with us right now, I'm going to turn this over to JP for some discussion of themes that include ice cream.
Nothing new here, so this is going to drive home some common themes that we've been talking about. The first is commerce, or the apparent lack of it in this case. Consider this really ties two instruments of national power to each other. When we talk about commerce, one is economics, the other is the military. As with other books in the arc, the size and capability of the Navy is tightly tied to the economic strength of Manticore in general, and specifically its trade and traffic potential. And then I'll just say it and move to the next one. I hope people's brains went right to the whole thing about the potential of having a wormhole junction in the vicinity of Manticore.
Yeah. They've got to follow up with that somehow in this.
We know it's not like a spoiler. There is one there because these books are happening in the past, but there is a story to be told about how they work all this out. Economics is the second one, and I'm using the term broadly. The economic potential of the Star Kingdom is really what's at play, and I just basically spoiler-read that. Talking about commerce, so the suspicion is emerging as to why they were attacked. They seem to be figuring that out and then quietly examining whether or not that's true. And so we see the Manticoran interest in this potential wormhole. They read the signs. They're like, wait a minute, maybe this is what's going on. A wormhole junction, which if true, could make the quote unquote backwater Stark Kingdom into an economic powerhouse. Jumping over to alliances, a part of the D in the dime. We've seen elsewhere in the Honorverse that allies can be a powerful benefit. We've been talking about the Andromani and Manticore, but also can become a detrimental entanglement. So that tension is always there when you talk about alliances forming or enduring or falling apart. The interactions between Andromani Empire and the Stark Kingdom of Manticore is very interesting, especially given Manticore is in the context in the position of being a developing nation.
I really think your parallel just nailed it with Manticore and Grayson. It really does.
And I'm even mindful of the fact that, and again, I don't know where this is going, and it may be nowhere at all. It's just cool to see kind of pay it forward, like you said, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
But the Andromani Empire is an empire. The Stark Kingdom is not, but it becomes an empire. Mm-hmm. They're just layers in here that are, at a minimum, it's just cool. If this was a part of why it was written this way, there's a quiet lesson here, maybe, in how friends help friends or friends help potential or future friends. The fourth one is mercenaries. Common theme across this part of the Honorverse, the story arc inside the Honorverse. They're here and they're active. The story gives some consideration to how legitimate a mercenary force is. It might be an interesting exercise in comparing how mercenaries are considered versus how pirates are considered. And we've talked about pirates before.
Mm-hmm.
How they're the same, how they're different, and such. By the way, a second interesting exercise might be to consider when and if and how a mercenary or pirate force can be considered a transnational, or in this universe, an interstellar. We, in the real world, talk about transnational organizations and transnational entities today, the real world version of these interstellars that we see. It goes back to what constitutes lawful conduct on the high seas or in deep space, as well as what's considered lawful and acceptable in terms of political power. The mercenaries or the pirates are an extension of, or even that the mercenaries or pirates are not just an extension of, but the power that they are in and of themselves.
The thing is, the mercenaries, at least as we see them here, and what you just said there about lawful conduct on the high seas, there tends to be specific law and regulation that governs mercenaries in that context that separates them from pirates.
Yeah, we see it in here, right?
Yeah, it's like there's a line you cross from mercenary to pirate, and it's not a gray line. It's a clear, very stark, distinct line.
And it may not be only this, but who you work for, therefore whose authority you're exercising matters.
Which is going exactly. That's exactly where I'm going. If you're for hire and you get a mark to privateer, you know, a mark from the crown, it's like, you know, the line to from mercenary to privateer. And yeah, it's like, how do privateers, Jim, fit?
I want to come back to that, what you just said, Raul.
Yeah. Pirates are loyal to no one but themselves. Mercenaries are loyal to those that pay them.
Which may or may not be the crown or a sovereign entity.
Right.
It could be an unlawful entity that's hired the mercenaries.
Yep.
And then, because Raul, you mentioned privateers, remember there's something historically unique about an entity that is deemed to be a privateer, and that is that they are operating not only on behalf of what we'll call a lawful authority, but privateers are protected under the laws of war because they operate under a commission.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're not military, they are operating under a commission like a military force does. So there's a line there as well that's important to understand. Privateers aren't necessarily mercenaries.
But we do get it, yeah.
Mercenaries are typically not privateers, or they would be called privateers.
True. And
pirates are none of the above.
But you also get because one of the things, and this is what made me think about this, is there are specific legal protections for the capture of mercenaries in at least this universe.
Yes. Yes. Yep.
I think it's just cool the way they blend the distinctions.
Yeah, and I gotta believe that there's a lot of super smart people in Bureau 9 that have allowed David to kind of bring these things up without turning it
Tom
into
Pope,
a,
for example.
A textbook lesson. Yeah, yep. So cool stuff. People can read past it and enjoy the story and not know that it's there,
mm-hmm.
but it is there, and there's some depth for the geeks out there, the naval geeks or the military geeks, to enjoy the nuances, the distinctions that are happening. And then the final one is, again, something that keeps coming up very recently, is that considering what constitutes or differentiates between insurrection, insurgency, a coup, and I'll leave, and I'm not going to define them. It's just out there for everyone to consider, but I'll leave you with something that I said before. While they're not the sole things that define or distinguish between these labels or categories, but context and perspective truly do matter, right? One man, the old one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist kind of thing. We talked about it with the ballroom. That kind of problem set is emerging here too, as we're looking at challenges to legal power and claims and the role of the quintessence, and all of this different stuff is cooking. And when you look back, and we have a sentence of death ultimately bestowed upon somebody who is an insurrectionist, or a, you know, like, it's another cool problem that's here with stuff that all seems to touch, and context matters, kind of like the pirates versus mercenaries versus.
Yeah, context matters, but also who wins at the end also seems to matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
History, yeah, is people written by the victors.
Right.
So those are the themes I came up with. Do you guys have any other ones?
No, I think this is good, and this was a great discussion on it too.
Yeah.
Well, then I'm going to hand back off to you, Raul.
Nah, go ahead and hand it off to Jim for some plot points.
Okay. So I have two. First, the entire co-plot with Chomps being sent to the Sarisburg Dookie as a handyman for an older couple who live there, but winds up investigating a murder. I think this was the first time we get to see Chomps out on his own. And after what was in this story, I hope we get more of him as a featured character. This part gives me a little frustration with the story. It did get a little tiresome when he would point something out to the deputy sheriff, Terry Lasseline, and she would respond with, "I'm the deputy sheriff, and my training and experience means I know more than you." Okay, and that happened so many times.
Sadly, I've met people with that attitude before.
I know, but darn it. Anyway, she relied on this excuse to not listen to Chomps on several occasions, making it a cliche. For my taste, it just happened too many times. At the same time, when Terry did start to listen to Chomps, it showed growth in the character. So another showing of character growth appeared with Andrew, later to be named Gustav II, as he traveled to Tomlinson with Gustav Cortage. The Andermani ship Preussen is boarded and taken over by Tomlinson rebels, being led by Florence Hansen, and Andermani captain who joined the rebels against Andrew. Andrew wants the Cortage fleet to attack immediately, but his commanders and other advisors explain to him that he is in no position to put his life at risk in such an operation. The guy pitches a tantrum. I can't think of any other way to put it. Disputing those who are only concerned about his safety, and tells them in a rage that they will be executed once the Tomlinson issue is resolved. Later, after the rebels and mercenaries are defeated, he sees reason and not only forgives his officers, but apologizes to them for being so rash in his thinking. But again, he summarily sentences his own half-sister to be executed. So those are my two plot points. How about you, JP?
I think it's very cool continuing to see the Manticoran Navy in its childhood, if that's a fair way to characterize them. Clearly inferior in terms of their equipment and their doctrine. We get to watch the Star Empire continue to learn from others like the Andromani, or in particular the Andromani. And we sort of talked about even what that might be foreshadowing when we see a mature Star Empire. Star Kingdom at the time of this story, but yeah. Star Empire eventually. The only other one I had was the impact of war and combat on people, and how in the real world, what we learn may be truly accurate, but not complete in terms of small but significant details that can bring color to those combat events. This wasn't really heavily emphasized, but it was done. I thought it was done very well. And in my quote will tie to this. How about you, Raul?
Okay. The development of the cordial relationship between the Star Kingdom and the Andromani. And I've talked about this all throughout the podcast. That really was a fun part, because you see the roots being, you see the seeds being planted that are going to grow into the relationship in the present era. It was just really, really fun to watch. Another piece for me was finally getting some real closure on the development between Travis and Gavin's relationship. In the first three books, at best, it was frosty.
Yeah.
Now we've seen them together. We've seen them in action together. And I'm really, really hoping that in the final book that we see that they've remained close. I hope it wasn't a case of promises made, promises forgotten, as far as keeping in touch and spending more time together. And I suspect Lisa wouldn't allow that.
Yeah.
So
she seems to like, obviously she loves Travis, but she likes his brother. And yep. This was, I think this was the first time that both those boys got to see things happening that allowed them to gain real respect for each other.
They each saw the other doing what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you're exactly right. I really like the Chomps plot. And like I said before, there were points where I think I might have liked it too much because of the way the action would shift back and forth.
Yeah.
But at the point of the podcast we're in now, and yeah, I already know I mentioned it, but I'm going to stick with this approach. The end felt kind of weak. It's like, to keep her job, she killed a family. But then we get the final pages of the book, which I'll get to when we do our final recaps.
Okay.
And I'm going to give this to you, Jim.
Yeah. So we'll talk about some quotes. I will go ahead and kick this caption off. This is the apology Andrew issued to the previously condemned officers. "I assume you all remember our last meeting," Andrew said. "You recall I wanted to immediately attack the Tomlinson traitors. All of you stood as one to defy that order, insisting I be returned to Potsdam and safety before returning to bring them to justice. Now, because of that delay, it would appear that many more good men and women have been forced to give their lives for the Empire." He paused, looking again around the table. Maria held her breath, noting the quiet stiffness in the others' postures and their carefully controlled expressions. "However," Andrew continued, "I say it would appear because none of us truly knows what would have happened if you'd attacked as I wished. We know the insurgents received additional ships during the delay, but we don't definitely know how much of their force was already prepared. Most significantly, we don't know the state of the massive missile ambush that came close to costing the entirety of Admiral Basaltberg's force. If even a large percentage of it was already in place at the time, none of us might be here now." He paused again, but this time Maria could see a hint of a smile touching his face. "An emperor cannot afford to have his word flouted for no reason," he said. but likewise an emperor cannot afford to ignore the sound advice, whether or not in the heat of the moment he judges it to be sound. He raised his eyebrows. And an emperor certainly cannot afford to destroy the voices that offered that counsel. I imagine some of you at least came here today expecting to hear a pronouncement of judgment on you. Instead, I offer my apologies and gratitude. We don't know how an earlier battle might have turned out, but we do know that my life and the stability of the empire would have been put at risk. I therefore withdraw the punishments I threatened you with and ask your forgiveness for my hasty and ill-considered speech. You are our emperor, Majestate, the Kanzerline said gravely, the weight of her long-serving mixing with relief. But like all of Gott's servants, you are also human. We will always extend forgiveness to you for your errors if you will likewise extend such forgiveness to us. Thank you, Andrew said. And now I'll allow you to return to your duties. But in 3 short weeks' time, I will marry my beloved. A short time after that, I expect there to be an heir to the imperial throne. After that, if you ever again wish to keep me out of battle, you'll need to come up with a new excuse.
That was awesome.
It was good.
Yeah, that was
very good pick.
My favorite. How about you, JP?
This quote captures Winterfall's thoughts as he studied Navy reports, as well as the discussions with Travis, Marcello, and Lisa regarding recent combat ops. And I said my quote would tie to that theme. It also captures the real difference between the detailed experiences of those in the fight versus what makes it into official reports and histories. By the way, none of this has to be taken in a negative light. It's just the practical reality of war. And I thought the book captured it well. Winterfall had spent a great deal of time on the voyage from Manticore poring over the RMN's reports on those two engagements. But as he listened to Travis, and then to Captain Marcello and Lisa, he found himself continually surprised by how much more detail there was to a battle than ever made it into the official accounts. Nothing factual had been left out of the reports, of course, but now he was getting the additional layers of sensation, emotion, anticipation, and chagrin, and sometimes even gallows humor that turned a simple rendition into a vivid tapestry. He was also struck at how strongly and permanently those facts and emotions were etched into the participants' memories. It had been over a year since the Manticorans had fought against the Volsungs, but all three of them spoke as if the battles had been yesterday. War sometimes changes people. Winterfall had heard that adage bandied about most of his adult life, and he'd always believed it. Now, he realized it was wrong. The word wasn't sometimes, it was always. How about you, Raul?
Really good one there. I actually have three. Two of them are very short, and one is not that long, but I had to include it for you, JP. The first one actually is a little bit later in the book. This is on the ship, Travis talking to Lisa. And actually, my final quote is really like right after that. But I've got to include this one. They're talking about their two, they each have their own handler touring the ship and bringing them up to speed. And they're talking about their senses of humor. Now, if you know David Weber, and if you watch his Facebook page, you are inundated with puns. This is a man that is a strong believer in letting the punishment fit the crime, as it were. Okay? So when I saw this, I was like, okay, David, you really had to go there, didn't you? And here's the line. You'll have to work on that, Travis told her. If nothing else, I'd love to see a pun contest in German between her and Corinno. If you know, you know. So I had to include that one. Now to the main two quotes. This is actually a reference to Quint but it's two of her officers on one of the other ships talking about her. It just kind of struck me. War isn't about glamour, Jamshidi reminded her, watching the same display. As Commander Juliana Quint once said, war is about shooting the other guy first, in the back if necessary.
It's not wrong.
Yeah. Now, the last quote, this is jumping right back to the conversation between Travis and Lisa. And I really could have put the two of them together, but I felt like I needed to keep them separated because this one is a little more serious comment. Because between that first quote, Lisa says, I'll see what I can do, Lisa promised, in between getting my head stuffed with details, and then picking up the actual quote part. Yeah, Travis said, sobering. I just can't help thinking about what Basaltberg said at dinner about unpredictability. The approach to battle must always be as methodical and controlled as possible, Lisa quoted, for it is a given that once combat begins, one will inevitably face unpredictable events. One must therefore prepare carefully and thoroughly ahead of time, Travis picked up the rest of Basaltberg's words, in order to prevent mistakes from creeping in any earlier than possible, and to give oneself the strongest platform from which to react to those elements when they present themselves. It does lend itself to easy memorization, doesn't it? Huh. And it just struck me as one of those life truths, and not just for war.
Yeah.
And my question, JP, this is actually a quote that was created for the book? This isn't a quote of someone else in a text on the nature of warfare, or a text on tactics or strategy?
It didn't. I don't know of that quote elsewhere. I think it was written for the book.
Okay.
Could be wrong. But
but it does feel like it has a ring of truth to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. And on that, I'm going to turn it over to you, JP.
Well, I'm going to do what you did and follow your lead. And I'm going to turn it over to Jim for some closing thoughts.
All right.
And any takeaways you might have?
Sounds good. So as I said at the outset, this is, so far, the weakest of the series, in my opinion. That's not to say that it isn't worth the time to read it. It's a very good for numerous reasons. We get to see deeper inside the Andromani Empire and how the relationship between them and the Star Kingdom came to be. We also get Chomps in a storyline of his own, and I think we were overdue on that score. He is a great character and deserving of the spotlight. Now we have an heir to Elizabeth I, and to my surprise, the father was not Joshua Miller, the member of Parliament who became her consort in A Call to Vengeance, but rather Elizabeth's deceased husband apparently had his sperm frozen for just this purpose. Or at least that's the official story at this point. On top of everything, Jeremiah Lin is back to try and cause more mayhem to take attention away from the Manticore system so Axelrod can get control over the wormhole thought to be there. He's not the most popular guy with Axelrod because of his previous failure, but it just remains to be seen how he fares with them when they learn about his latest faux pas. Again, a good book worth the time. I'll just add that there had better be at least one more book in this series to tie up the loose ends left in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Over to you, JP.
Well, I'm gonna build on that, I think. I also agree, not the most, I wouldn't say it was the weakest, but I just hadn't thought of it in those terms. Certainly not the most powerful book in the arc, but solid in the best of senses. I thought it wrapped the series up well, and that if there wasn't anything that followed it, there wouldn't be any hate coming from me. It was kind of left hanging out there in a way that the story could continue in my mind as a reader. I don't feel ripped off, I guess, or anything like that. Given that we know there's more coming, though, you know, then it's like, what's in it? What more will come? I hope more is written in this arc and not generically, because we know that's coming. But Jim, you had mentioned the plague, and that's a significant event in the Honorverse. And I think that there's huge potential for that. More on that. I even think that there could be a series written on the plague years. I'm not sure, because I don't know what is in David's head in terms of the depth of story that's there, but it seems like, man, there could be a wild ride viewed through the eyes of characters we may not even know as the plague ravaged Manticore. So interesting, but like I said, if nothing more happened, certainly if that's not explored, I'm a happy guy. I'm a content reader. How about you, Raul?
Like I said, it was a very fun read, though it was a bit tricky between the two stories.
Yeah.
It's really, really sad for me that there's likely only one more book in this arc. Hopefully, at least, if not any more from there. And I know I get how busy Timothy Zahn has to be right now with everything going on for him. But hopefully, at the very least, it can get continued later in some of the short stories. It was a development story. So I know that it was a little slower once realizing that is not really a huge surprise. But wow, it still did so much better than a development novel, keeping you engaged in like, what's next? And speaking of what's next, I am very anxiously awaiting the end of Lynn's story. The epilogue definitely is setting that up. So that seems to be some part of the piece that's going to pull all of this series together. I do hope they approach this fifth book from the perspective of giving us a satisfying end there. And one thing saved up for this final plot point, I have to admit, I was really caught off guard by the Crystal Pines twist. We didn't get that final twist on the Chomp storyline until the very final pages of the book. And originally, I wasn't going to bring it up at all. I was just going to grump about it and save that point of the plot twist for here. And I was going to do that because it was disconcerting on the journey itself. But oh my God, the payoff was fantastic. Where and how they timed it. So for all the grumping earlier, brilliantly done. You got me, gentlemen. You got me. David, Timothy, Tom, well done there. That was a great plot twist payoff. That could be a lesson for other authors. And those are my final thoughts and takeaway. So from here, do we want to turn to ratings?
Of course.
Jim.
So, I gave this a 4.5 scoops of ice cream from the Plaza Parlor in Whistle Stop.
Ice cream.
Does anyone remember a store called Whistle Stop?
I really don't.
Is it a St. Louis thing?
I don't know if it was St. Louis or beyond that. It was like a little country store thing.
Oh. So, what's your rating, JP?
I gave it 5. That would be 5 defeated mercenary naval forces. How about you, Raul?
And for me, as you, which should be surprised to no one, I gave it 4.5 unexpected plot twists.
Very good. Altogether, that gives us a 4.7 with Goodreads reporting 4.44 with 1,680 ratings, and Amazon is right with us at 4.7 with 2,679 ratings. So that's where it is.
Awesome.
Yeah. Nice.
And our shout out tonight is to Mr. Hank Davis, founder of the great TPE network of fun yet informative podcasts. Check out the great content available from the Tiger Prince himself.
Yeah. And for those who did send in comments, we will definitely be covering them next time.
Okay. And on our next very exciting episode of Honorverse Today, we will dig our claws into the fourth book in the Star Kingdom series, A New Clan by David Weber and Jane Linscold. This one promises to be loaded with sex, drugs, rock and roll, and three cats. So
you're not wrong.
Yeah. So you will not want to miss that next episode. And so,
yes.
Yeah. And so with that, good night, JP.
Good night, JP.
Good night, everybody. It's been fun, yeah. As always.
So long, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Honorverse today. We welcome your feedback. Email us at honorverse@tpenetwork.com. We are a proud part of TPE Network. Visit us on the web at honorverse.net, on social media, or tpenetwork.com. You can subscribe to Honorverse today by visiting tpenetwork.com/subscribe. Visit TPE Network for the very best in podcasting. Opinions expressed in the show are solely those of the hosts. They do not reflect the opinions or views of Bain Books, the authors, or TPE Network. Visit Bain.com for the best in science fiction. Many of their books are available from the Bain Free Library found at their site. Theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Valaha. Check his website found in the show notes for all your podcasting music needs.
Today, we are going to be talking about a call to insurrection. Blah.
Is the illegitimate... You are our emperor, Majestat, said the Kanzerlein, said grave.
You just spoke German.
Yeah. Jawohl. Okay.